In U.S. working forests, or forest land carefully managed to provide a steady, renewable supply of wood for daily use, more than 1 billion trees are planted every year, and forestry experts protect and manage hundreds of millions of acres. Working forests have been sustainably managed for decades. How? It's simple. They plant more trees than they harvest. Learn more at workingforestsinitiative.com.
Support for this show comes from Sylvan Learning. When children love learning, they can tackle any challenge life throws at them. Sylvan's Insight Assessment can help you determine if your child is ready for what's ahead. It can also identify gaps in learning and point out areas that could be of concern for your child so they can tackle what's to come. And right now, it's the best price of the year at $29. Go to sylvan29.com to learn more and get your child's assessment for only $29. That's sylvan29.com.
This is The Weeds. I'm Jonquilin Hill. If you're a parent, or if you know one, you've almost certainly heard about the trials and tribulations of trying to find and pay for childcare. This issue has gotten a ton of attention since the pandemic exposed how essential childcare is for all of us. Because so many parents work, this care is critical for a functioning economy. But access to affordable childcare was a challenge long before COVID.
My mom, when she was looking for childcare for me, I was her third, I was her baby, and in our town, there was only one daycare center that had an infant spot, and they had one spot.
That's Catherine Ann Edwards. She's a labor economist and also writes a column for Bloomberg.
Sign up started on Monday morning. So Friday night, she went out to the parking lot with a tent and a sleeping bag and a best friend and slept out there.
And if her voice sounds familiar, that's because it is. Catherine joined us a few episodes back to imagine a future where retirement security was guaranteed. While we were taping that episode, she told me this story about childcare.
She slept out there for two nights or three nights, but she also said that, like, she wasn't alone. By Sunday night, before the sign-up opened, I mean, there was a row of 10 sleeping outside this daycare because this was the only option, and they had a party for the kids, and they, like, brought barbecues, and, like, the kids played with their parents, and it was like, good night, Mom, have fun sleeping in a parking lot to get, you know, our baby sister care. And, of course, I got care. She was first in line, and when she asked me about searching for childcare for my kid, she's like, is it still that bad? I'm like, oh, we have the internet. We don't have to sleep outside.
I was about to say, it's like the difference between sleeping outside for concert tickets and, you know, waiting in the Ticketmaster queue.
It's like, oh, well, we don't have to sleep outside anymore. We have to pay $700 to apply to 10 places, and we have no idea if we get in, and they just take our money. That's what the internet did. It increased fees and reduced the amount of sleeping outside.
The more things change, the more they stay the same. Today on The Weeds, Catherine Ann Edwards is back with a plan to solve the childcare crisis.
I am a little stuffed up, so I've prepped Sophie for all the editing of, like, blowing noses she'll have to take out of this.
As you can hear, Catherine was battling a cold when we spoke, and the way she got it was kind of ironic.
I saw a TikTok about this where this guy was talking about how whenever his brother gets sick, it's like he gets sick in the Middle Ages. And he's like, yeah, he just, like, coughs up blood and he's shivering and pale. and he always says, Sophia brought something home with daycare. And he's like, what do kids in daycare do? Clean up medical waste? Like, and my husband and I have been laughing about that for weeks because sometimes we'll get sick from our children and we're like, what in God's name did you do to me?
Also, it's perfect that, like, your kids brought you sickness from daycare and we're talking about childcare today. Like, that is so perfect.
It's like there are many things that we don't talk about daycare. One of them is how it's, like, slowly killing parents.
So before we jump in, I do want to acknowledge the fact that, you know, there are so many factors when it comes to the success of a child in early childhood. And a lot of that is prenatal care, you know, and that could be its own separate episode of The Weeds. But we're going to be talking about, you know, that 0 to 5 period for children. Can you talk a little bit about the importance of early childhood and how that factors into someone's setup for the rest of their life?
One way to explain it is just imagine your whole life in 5-year increments, 20 to 25, 16 to 21, whatever, you know, 70 to 75. There is no period that comes even close to the amount of growth and development and transformation that happens from the day you're born till the day you turn 5. It's just an unimaginable amount of change and development, and it is an opportunity to foster the best development possible for children, because that time can't be replaced or replicated. It's its own science of this idea of child development, and we just don't really give it much attention in the U.S.
I think it is more than fair to say that the U.S. has a child care crisis, and you have called this crisis a situation of market failure. What does child care, and we're talking about this 0 to 5 period of time, what does that look like in the U.S. right now? What are the circumstances we have?
Early childhood starts at -1, when you are in utero and you are growing. And at every point from -1 to 5, your health, your nutrition, and your education will almost entirely be determined by how rich your mom is. And if you wanted to characterize in one sweeping statement what is wrong with childcare, it's that. Most of the investments that parents can make in children before they turn 5, when they're eligible for kindergarten, they have to buy. Whatever those services are almost always determined by a market, and that market does not value fairness. That market doesn't value that you are trying very hard for your children. The market only values the money that you have. Childcare, the center or family or nanny service or unpaid friend or family care where your child is while you are at work, is a almost exaggeration of the differences between rich and poor. Right now, the cost of childcare in the United States is higher than college tuition in most states. It's higher than mortgages in most states. That price has been rising faster than food, energy, and even prescription drugs over the past 3 decades. And if you can kind of close your eyes and imagine the number of times a presidential candidate has talked about prescription drugs, or the number of policy, you know, action there's been in Congress about the price of prescription drugs, childcare is rising faster. And we don't have the same type of intervention. On top of all of this, the quality differences that come from this incredibly expensive good are staggering. And there are just a lot of children that are in subpar care situations where they don't get the same type of investment that a rich mom with a lot of command on the market can make sure she gets for her kid.
I want to talk about some more of these numbers. I mean, there simply is not enough childcare for the people who need it. And we've heard how expensive it is. The fact that it's higher than college tuition, just, oh my gosh, that is breathtaking. Yeah, like how much childcare is available?
So the number of slots declined significantly in the pandemic with the number of people working in childcare. So childcare is ratioed, meaning that you can't have like 40 kids in a room with one adult. You know, in every locality, there's a ratio that you have to maintain. So if 1 million people lose their job in daycare, you're basically losing, you know, 4 to 8 times that slot, because that person supports 4 spots. So childcare employment declined by about a third in the pandemic, and then it slowly recovered over many years, much slower than the labor market overall. So right now, our best guess is that we might have as many slots as we did in the winter of 2019. But we don't keep great track of it. We don't have a centralized database of the number of spots. We do look at the number of centers and the number of family care providers. The number of center-based care has recovered in the pandemic, but family-based care has not.
So, okay, there's this idea of universal birth to kindergarten childcare. What is this plan you've concocted? How would it work?
You, as a child, move through 3 different types of care arrangements based on whether or not your parents want to take advantage of them. It starts with paid leave, so that when you're born, you have a parent home with you who is being paid to do so through their kind of a wage replacement program. And then you age into childcare, which lasts until 3. And then when you are 3, you do 2 years of preschool. And so each one has its own kind of like primary provider, primary purpose, primary setting, and you kind of advance through them.
So can you talk a little bit about like how this all works? Like who gets what spots? Like what's going on?
The most important thing is that it doesn't really look anything like how we have to do it today. So that's good. So now I'm a government. I'm the Catherine government, and I've decided that everyone lives in Catherine land gets free childcare. How do I do this? The market's broken. It's been broken for forever. The prices are insane. Most of the way that the federal government provides childcare assistance is based on a market subsidy. So you tell me how much parents are paying for childcare, and the federal government is going to give me back some money in return. If you wanted to have universal childcare, that would be a disastrous way to go about it. And no one really wants to do that, except for maybe there are some Republicans who want to have like more generous tax credits. That is kind of like a bad version of that terrible plan. But no, if I wanted to provide childcare in Catherine land, I wouldn't completely ignore market prices. I would just pretend that a market didn't exist, and I would look at the cost of providing care. Mm-hmm. And more importantly, I wouldn't look at the cost of providing care right now when it is conditional on what parents and the market for that care provider can afford. I would look at kind of an estimated cost of high quality care, and I would basically reimburse centers who are meeting quality standards at the cost that I've estimated for that quality to cost.
Mm-hmm. And so like this idea of coming in on the supply side rather than the demand side. Could you talk about that a little bit? And also, what does coming in on that supply side look like in practice?
So in a market-based system, which is what we have now, slots are apportioned to the highest bidder, and the government can kind of come in on the back end to help people be able to bid more, but you have rationed childcare through the price side, which means poor people don't get it. On a supply side intervention, you would have a separate rationing problem, which is that people would not have a spot available to them because there aren't sufficient number of spots to meet the demand. So you have to basically build out the supply side over a period of time to meet the demand that's wanted. And the people who don't get it, it's not because they can't afford it, simply because there aren't enough spots available.
Have we seen any examples of this government-backed childcare in the past or present?
Yes, the federal government in 1989 passed the Military Child Care Act to fund basically the exact same thing that people want for the rest of us, to fund childcare for members of the military. And it was, you know, a messy rollout. It took them a few years to get it right. But now the type of childcare that service members have access to is better than what most of us could buy. And the federal government provides it. They do it on a cost of service basis, and it is widely available. So right now, the federal government does provide and run a child care system that is very popular and is very high quality. We just don't all get to benefit from it.
I want to talk about some places that have that are trying to find solutions. And one of them is one of my admittedly many home states, New Mexico. What is going on in the land of enchantment with childcare?
The land of the beautiful desert of New Mexico, over the past couple of years, has decided that they are going to fund universal access to childcare. They wrote it into their constitution. They created a trust fund for it, and they are in the kind of multi-year process to basically provide childcare, either free or near free, to every kid who wants it in New Mexico. And they are the first state to do this. And honestly, I was surprised. I thought D.C. would do it first, because over the past 15 years, D.C. has moved faster on a lot of other aspects of childcare. So D.C. has universal pre-3 and pre-4. They're the only locality in the country that does. So I thought that they would move from 0 to 3 first. But no, New Mexico got there first, and they just passed it. And I think there's a couple states that are very close to doing something similar.
What happened when this plan was rolled out in New Mexico. What was the response like? And yeah, how'd that go?
They're still rolling it out. So they set up a multi-year kind of phase-in process to start this system. But, you know, at every step, they've had more people want childcare than they thought. Not surprising. I mean, surprising and not surprising. What's surprising about it is that Americans in surveys and in polls have been very kind of reluctant to give up this idea that the best thing for a kid is to have a parent stay at home with them until kindergarten. That still polls really well. But it doesn't necessarily match the reality of like, well, what if we have free childcare? People are like, take this kid, you know, just like, get him out of my house. And I think that that duality is really natural and very expected, that people have, you know, conflicting notions of what and inconsistent notions of what is best for their kid. But most people come down on the side of, if I can get my kid into early education and if that supports me both paying less out of pocket and being able to get more income for my family, that is what is best for my kid.
How do you manage expectations during the growing pains of a process like this? Because there simply just are not enough spots for all of the children.
I'm very confident that the U.S. will have fully subsidized federal child care within the next 10 years. And the rollout is going to be a disaster because people are going to want it immediately and it won't be available. So I think we can do a better job than healthcare.gov, if y'all remember that.
I remember that rollout.
Yeah, that was a great, what a great day. I mean, that was just so many of like, why did you not know people go to a website at the same time? But I mean, I think, yeah, it takes a lot of managing expectations and it takes a lot of prioritizing. And I think what you can expect is that states will have control over the childcare process in their state, and they'll choose different, basically, rollout methods of who comes first. So you're going to have some states that say the centers go to the poorest families first, and you'll have some states say, basically, we're going to, like, publicize a center one at a time. So, like, all the current centers, everyone who's currently in there is now in, and then we'll just start building out supply. So the people will go in different orders, and it'd probably be like a 3-year, lots of patience, lots of communication. We're doing this and we're on our way. But even, I will argue, even that 3-year transition, which maybe we could do in 2, but even that 3-year transition would still be better than what we have now of waiting 3 years for a childcare spot that you might not get, but you paid $1,000 to put your name on a list. Wait, you know, not knowing how much care is going to cost, being in care and having prices increased by $500 in a year and you have no other option. I mean, it's the lack of power that parents have now, the control over that the market has over early childhood is the worst timeline. So it'll be a mess when we transition, but it'll still be better. Even that mess will be better than the nadir that we're at now.
Okay, so universal birth to kindergarten care is the dream, but you can't implement a policy like this without people to do it. That's after the break. Support for The Weeds comes from Not Another Politics Podcast from the Harris School of Public Policy. With the constant news cycle, there's a lot of noise out there. Opinions are plastered all over social media, pundits are throwing out hot takes without any sort of context, and it's only getting worse as we dive farther into election season. We know that if you're listening to us at The Weeds, you're looking to cut through all this. And if you like this show, you might like Not Another Politics Podcast. Not Another Politics Podcast is produced by the University of Chicago Harris School of Public Policy. They want to take a research and data approach to analyzing hot button issues and offer perspectives that go beyond the headlines. They cover a wide variety of topics in their episodes, but a few recent episodes that you can listen to include a deep dive into why women are underrepresented in U.S. politics or whether or not we can believe political surveys. You can listen and subscribe today at harris.uchicago.edu/NAP. That's NAPP. Support for The Weeds comes from Mint Mobile. Some might say that sauce is what makes us a proper society. Like, imagine a world without hot sauce, or barbecue sauce, or Worcestershire sauce, or however it's pronounced. It's inconceivable. Well, Mint Mobile agrees, and their secret sauce is that they sell their wireless service totally online. They don't worry at all about retail costs, and they say that lets them pass those savings on to you. It's why their premium wireless plans start at just $15 a month. With Mint Mobile, you could say goodbye to an overpriced monthly phone bill or unexpected fees. All of their plans come with unlimited talk and text, plus high-speed 5G data. Signing up is super easy, and you could even bring your own phone and phone number with you to your new plan when you switch. To get this new customer offer and your new 3-month unlimited wireless plan for just $15 a month, you can go to mintmobile.com/weeds. That's mintmobile.com/weeds. You could cut your wireless bill to $15 a month at mintmobile.com/weeds. Additional taxes, fees, and restrictions apply. See Mint Mobile for details.
In U.S. working forests, or forest land carefully managed to provide a steady, renewable supply of wood for daily use, more than 1 billion trees are planted every year, and forestry experts protect and manage hundreds of millions of acres. Working forests have been sustainably managed for decades. How? It's simple. They plant more trees than they harvest. Learn more at workingforestsinitiative.com.
So I'm talking with economist Catherine Edwards about fixing childcare, and we recently heard from a listener who works in the industry. She had a really good question.
Hi, my name is Ella Kisior, and my question is about childcare. What are some ways we can incentivize more educators to get into the field and to stay in it? I hear of a lot of employers offering flexible hours to try to incentivize people to come work for them, and this is something that a lot of parents also want in childcare, more hours in the day or overnights and weekend coverage. But what about parents like me who are also providing the childcare?
This is a great question. And I think that it is a perfect example of the type of fun conversations we can have with childcare when we move beyond it's complicated to let's be creative about how to provide the best early childhood education. You know, moving beyond just cost formulas and who gets the service provision in the transition, like this is where the true capability of a better early childhood system shines through things like what type of job is it? So right now, it's not a good job. It doesn't pay well. It pays very poorly relative to other occupations that are seemingly very important. And there's very little room for upward development and mobility on the job. And it doesn't have security. It doesn't have benefits. It doesn't have any of those things. So the way that this would change, so not what it would look like, but why would it be different, is that in cost estimation models, as opposed to pricing models, in cost estimation models, you decide the salary rather than what the market can support. It's the salary you think the workers deserve. So the District of Columbia has decided that they're going to transition all of their childcare workers to be making basically what a preschool teacher makes. That is a decision that they made because they're going to price it based on what people should make rather than what market can support in terms of salary. So the cost models support higher wages than the market can. So that's good. Kind of making the job good really comes down to what are the qualifications for the job and what type of professional development capacity does it have? So there's a group that comes out with guidance of how to estimate the cost of providing care. And they have three tiers: baseline quality cost, high quality cost, and then my favorite, aspirational quality cost. Like if we're aspirational. But for salary, the difference between those three are things like the number of days of professional development, the number of hours of retraining that they get each year, the number of hours of apprenticeship. And once you build into the cost model that you want the staff to have a good job, the capacity for the staff to have a good job gets so much higher, which sounds obvious, but is actually really important to stress. I think the other aspect of her question is, how do you meet the flexibility, both demands of the parent providers and the parent kind of seekers?
Yeah.
Right now, we only have the care that the market can support. If you had care that was not conditional on market, basically necessity, you could open up a lot more care options. So you could imagine a child care center, basically that is the aftercare center for a group of, you know, your kid goes there until 7 because you work late. You could imagine overnight centers, centers that go past dinner, all of those options that don't require you to make enough money to provide it because fewer people need care from 7 to 10 p.m. means that you can provide the care without having to meet some type of market clearance. And so that the cost of care allows you to be creative, not just about how good the job is, but when the job is offered and to whom.
I think one interesting thing that you sort of talked about and touched on, which, you know, I never thought about, was sort of this like professional development aspect. I'm curious what the career of a child care, early childhood care provider looks like now and what it would look like with this fan fiction we're writing.
Right now, it's a low-paying job. It is almost entirely women, and it does not have that much career progression from being, say, an assistant teacher to a lead teacher to a center manager. And most of the staff in many places do not have that much education or credentialing. In a world where we are paying for high-quality early educators, the National Academy of Sciences came together a few years ago to basically design what they think this job should look like. And they came out with a host of recommendations. But one of them is, you know, every public school in the U.S. should have a child development major and a child development associate's degree track that is built on the science of early childhood. And that within these careers, you should have the option for specialization of things like specialization in kind of like the psychology side, specialization in nutrition, specialization in, you know, curriculum and instruction. And that the kind of dream world of what these jobs look like is that you have career staff that are frequently educated, that are kind of tending towards specialization, and that have off-ramps or, you know, what we sometimes call career ladders, so that, you know, maybe they work on childhood nutrition at their center for 10 years, and then they decide they're going to start their own kind of daycare catering company. Or they decide they want to open up their own night center, and they want to start their own family-based center. The, you know, what makes a job good is very hard to define in a lot of ways, but you know it, right? Like, you know it, like your job right now, podcast host. You don't necessarily need to have this job for 30 years for it to be considered a good job. It's that you learn on the job about things. You learn about yourself and what you're good at and what you like. You have a boss and a mentor that's helping you through your career, and you have a network that is kind of setting you up for the next step. Most daycare providers currently would tell you they have none of those things.
Wow.
You know, the more you professionalize a job and the more you make a job about truly the service they're providing, we can make it a type of job that has things like mentors, that has career progression, that has networking, that has off-ramps into different opportunities that are taking advantage of your experience rather than abandoning it.
Yeah, I'm curious. I mean, and this goes beyond the economic, but you know, parents love their children. People are very serious about their kids. And I just wonder why, for a job that is so important, why is there this lack of resources and this lack of development when these people are taking care of what literally is the most important person in most people's lives?
Yeah, I mean, the market doesn't value children or the people who look after them, and it never will. You know, one thing I like to bring up with childcare is like there is no solution coming that doesn't come from the government. There's no way to make the math of profiting from taking care of tiny children to suddenly become lucrative. The only way you could do that is if you basically only catered to the wealthiest families and, you know, had lots of weird like amenities as part of your center so that you could charge like $4,000 a month, which there are investment companies that are moving into childcare with that exact model in mind. But for the rest of us, I mean, you just can't make money off of children, unfortunately.
I know. I'm just imagining like sushi for children, Like, that's, like, that is the way, I guess, to make money off of this.
Yeah, and but it's, you know, they're really, they're truly, I mean, you can ask any parent, they are a money-losing endeavor. And so if you've got part of their development is hinging on how much money you can make off of them, you know, it's just not, you're not going to get the best, because you can't make money off of looking after children. I mean, they just, it's like they eat money out of the air, and as any parent can tell you. So, you know, you can, the market can't afford the type of quality that kids deserve. And that's to say nothing of the parent's ability or the child's worth or the worker's worth for that matter. This is just not a money-making endeavor, but we have left it to the private sector for forever. And we have all the proof we need for decades now that it's not going to get better. This market will only get worse. It's going in one direction and it'll keep going that way. So I think parents could also tell you that they hate how little the daycare center workers make, and they don't like that it's not a better job, even if they're paying multiple thousands of dollars a month for their children to get care. They know that these workers don't have tons of money, and they don't like that either.
Okay, so children are a money suck, as I'm sure any parent will tell you. You're spending a lot of money on applesauce and those little veggie straws, which, you know, I get it. They're delicious. But I guess the literal multi-billion dollar question is, how much would universal childcare cost?
Low range estimate for, you know, 0 to 3 daycare and 3 to 4 preschool is around $400 billion, and the high range would be around $500 billion over a 10-year period. So I guess really what you're asking is, it's all monopoly money when we're talking about the federal government. So is that a lot for how much the federal government spends? I would argue no. And the reason why I would say no is that the federal government has shown the capacity to spend multiples of that without blinking, and we're fine. But when we want to spend it on children, you know, it's, oh my God, clutch your pearls about how much this would cost. But the example I give is that the 2017 tax cut, the Tax Cut and Jobs Act, is going to come in over a 10-year period at just under $2 trillion. And that was basically like a pennies on the dollar investment giveaway that we didn't see a lot back from. So that is 4 to 5 times what childcare would have cost over that period. So let's put that differently. We spent enough money in 2017 to fund 4 federal universal child care programs on top of each other.
400 to 500 billion. Up next, how we pay for it.
Support for this show comes from Sylvan Learning. As a parent, you want your child to have every opportunity. But giving them the tools they need to tackle every challenge, that takes a team. Now more than ever, educational support tailored exactly to what your child needs can make all the difference. That's why parents have trusted Sylvan Learning for 45 years as the ultimate teammate in their child's educational journey, instilling in them a love for learning and a passion for reaching the next level. And Sylvan's Insight Assessment can identify gaps in learning and areas that could be of concern for your child. It's a 360-degree view into your child's learning that you can't find anywhere else, and helps ensure that your child didn't miss something in school that might put them at a disadvantage in the future. And right now, it's the best price of the year at $29. Go to sylvan29.com to learn more and get your child's assessment for only $29. That's sylvan29.com.
Hi, everyone. I'm Brené Brown, and this is Unlocking Us. In this podcast, we'll explore ideas, stories, experiences, research, books, films, music, anything that reflects the universal experiences of being human, from the bravest moments to our most brokenhearted moments. Some episodes will be conversations with the people who are teaching me, challenging me, confusing me, maybe ticking me off a little bit. And some days I'll just talk directly to you about what I'm learning and how it's changing the way I think and feel. The first episodes are out now. We're going to do 3 or 4 part series every quarter, so about 12 to 15 episodes a year. Unlocking Us will always drop on Wednesdays. And now you can find me wherever you normally listen to your podcasts. You can get new episodes as soon as they are published by following Unlocking Us on your favorite podcast app. And as always, stay awkward, brave, and kind.
Once upon a time in America, there was no such thing as all-you-can-eat shrimp. And then the world changed.
Today, shrimp is the most popular, the most consumed seafood in America. The endless shrimp fiesta is an American institution.
But that shrimp fiesta comes at a steep price. Here at Gastropod, we found out that hidden behind the delicious shrimp on your plate is environmental disaster and modern-day slavery.
So can you have your shrimp and a clear conscience too? Actually, yes, and we've got the secret to help you unlock true, lifelong shrimp happiness. Listen to the latest episode of Gastropod wherever you get your podcasts.
Okay, Catherine, how would we pay for universal childcare? Where would this money come from?
So it would come out of general revenue, which is just the tax collections of the federal government from the income tax on households and businesses and the various other types of taxes, like the long-term capital gains tax, the estate tax, and things like that. All of that goes into general revenue, and then this would just come out of general spending, much like the way that the defense budget does or other programs like supplemental nutrition assistance. Those come out of general funds.
Could you talk about the estate tax a little bit? You have a very interesting proposal when it comes to the estate tax and childcare.
So the estate tax is the only federal wealth tax that we currently have, and it's a tax on dynastic wealth. Basically, if you die and you have a ton of money, like a ton of money, and that money is not going to a spouse, but is going down a generation to your kids have to pay taxes on it as if it were income. But like special types of incomes, like, say, long-term capital gains, it has its own tax rate and threshold. And so this is called the estate tax. It is the tax on very large inheritances that we have in the United States. My proposal was to dedicate the estate tax into a children's trust fund to fund, amongst other things, daycare, preschool, kind of more nutrition programs, and then with leftover funds, things like a child tax credit.
Side note, what is the estate tax revenue used for now?
It just goes into the general fund.
Okay. Would there be pushback on this idea of using the estate tax for childcare?
I think it would have maybe two types of pushback. The first would be there are other constituencies that have an eye on this money. Mm. So, you know, another proposal would be to use the estate tax to supplement Social Security for very poor elderly households. So, you know, if you think of like money having a purpose, this is taking the, you know, really excess wealth from very wealthy people who die typically when they're old. And so the idea is like they should pay that back to people who die, who are dying with like very little, and put the estate tax towards old people. So that would be one pushback is, yo, man, we're talking about like 1% of the, like, that's my money. Lots of people, like, I want that money. You know what we could use that money for? Whatever I care about the most. So there'll be that type of pushback. And then in general, the estate tax and how much money it collects has been really volatile because in these massive trillion-plus-dollar tax cuts we've seen over the past 2.5 decades, the estate tax is often one of the biggest changes is how much they collect, which estates are taxed, what is the amount, like the rate collected, and how it's calculated. So there have been massive tax giveaways for the estate tax. And so if you were to say we're going to dedicate it to children, that would make it a lot harder for an administration 5 years to say, well, we're going to put the estate limit for the estate tax up to $26 million, which is what it is around right now. So it would make it harder to cut this tax, and they love cutting it. I think that would be the other pushback is that it is a kind of favorite tax break, and it would be a lot harder to do if you were funding tiny little children grabbing money from the air.
Yeah, I feel like, you know, creating universal childcare, giving money to children, it feels like a political slam dunk. Like, no one's going to be like, you know what I hate? Babies. Like, no one is going to do that. But there are arguments against programs like this. And what is the argument against?
Well, I mean, there's the cost one, right? It's too expensive, which for an economy of more than $20 trillion, that is really a question of priorities and not capabilities. Like, we could absolutely afford this if we wanted to. So I don't find the costs question to be that genuine. We can spend $2 trillion to give a tax break to the wealthiest American companies and families. We can probably afford childcare. I don't believe in any type of argument that would say that would bust us. That's one argument against. The other argument against is a lot more nuanced about the role of family and parents versus the role of the government. And you would hear this kind of in two directions. One direction would be, it's not the government's job to raise your children. And then the other direction would be kind of on the personal responsibility front. If you can't have children, or if you can't afford children, don't have them. And they are two sides of the same coin, which is, it's not my fault that children are expensive. They're your kids. Well, I find that this argument probably has a really cruel interpretation that I try to give people the benefit of the doubt, that they don't actually think that low-income people don't deserve to pursue family life as everybody else, and they're not some kind of like fascist communist person deciding who gets children in the United States as a function of who has money, that they don't actually want that world. I think instead it comes from a misunderstanding of what families are up against and what the government's role is. The way that it's phrased makes it seem like whatever the government takes or provides, families will lose. And they're pitted against each other. And you have the sphere of the family and the sphere of the government. And as one expands, the other has to contract. That is truly not the right characterization of what's going on. Because what you have right now is families in one sphere and the market on the other. And what's expanding and taking autonomy away from families is the market for childcare, the market for wages that aren't sufficient, the market for health insurance that's unaffordable. Those markets are determining how much autonomy a family has. And when we're asking the government to intervene, we're not asking them to intervene in the family, we're asking them to intervene in the market. Mm. Not to reduce the power that families have, but to reduce the power that markets have over families in trying to raise their children. And so this idea of government versus family, it's missing what is the real bad guy. The real bad guy here is a childcare market where I'm paying more than a mortgage for someone making barely the minimum wage to watch my kid.
Yeah. Can you talk a little bit more about that personal responsibility piece? Because I can totally see a world where, you know, something like this gets through. But in order for it to get through, you know, there's going to be a senator who says, all right, I need a work requirement. I need XYZ. Can you talk about that personal responsibility piece? Because it pops up in so much policy.
I think that I have maybe a more cynical perspective here, but I think that this truly comes down to, you said children are a slam dunk, right? Like, what a popular policy to help children and babies. And yet, we don't have paid leave. Mm. We don't have childcare investments on a broad scale. We don't have preschool. So notionally, we would think children are such a win of an investment, and yet it is an investment that we don't make. So something is happening to wedge between children and the investment that we know is a good one, and it's their parents. And I think the reluctance to do this does not come from wanting to help children or even wanting to help families. It's not wanting to help parents that we don't like. And I tell people, you need to have this conversation. If we have universal childcare, there's going to be some, I could say dad, but we know it's going to be a mom that incites so much anger and reaction. There's going to be a mom at drop-off wearing like a bathrobe and slippers who doesn't like look like she's going to work after she drops off her kid. And she's going to have the same daycare that you have. And are you okay with that? Because if you're not, your problem is with helping poor parents and that you don't want to help poor children because you're going to have to benefit the parent that you don't like, versus you want to help all children. And in, you know, in the way that I talk about this, I relate this back to the American dream. If we truly want the American dream, that means that we want equal chance of success for all people, which means you have to find that mom that you don't like, right? Who looks poor, who looks like she's not working, who looks like, you know, maybe she is on drugs or has been on drugs in the past, and you have to want the best for her children and be willing for the government to help provide that, as opposed to maybe we should have a work requirement, right? I mean, a work requirement is just a way to say, I don't want to help parents I don't like. These are all just coded ways to say that there are lazy people and I don't want them to benefit from this. But the problem is that they have children. And so you either care about those children or you don't.
I want to get back into the fan fiction portion of it now. So, like, you know, we've instituted a universal birth to kindergarten childcare system. You know, it's 20 years in the future. We're in 2044. What does our world look like now? Like, what impact has this had?
Oh, this would be so transformative on so many levels. What's funny to me about having something like a work requirement for childcare is that a lot of people can't work until they have childcare.
Mm.
So if you were to roll out this program and assess it in 10 years, the two largest changes that you would see in the first 10 years is, one, you'd have a lot more moms working, and two, you would have a lot more economic security in families because they're not dedicating such a large portion of their income to childcare. And both of those would help families make other non-childcare investments in their children. So things like reducing food insecurity, you know, helping kids have, you know, more income. If they have a job, they might have access to health insurance or be better able to afford it. And then the kind of returns that you want to see come from the improved, basically, education and health of the kid. And those take a lot longer. And then there's lots of things that can mess up that investment before it matures, right? Like having a not good K through 12 system that they graduate into, having a bad economy in their locality, like lots of things can jeopardize the 0 to 5 investment. But for the most part, even if you just look at children and ignore the benefit to parents and working, it's a massively positive return.
Catherine Ann Edwards, thank you so much for joining us on The Weeds.
Thank you for having me. Thank you for having me back. It was delightful. I'm so happy to come back and to talk about childcare. We did people at the end. Now we're doing people at the beginning. Like, I love it. So excited to be here.
So that's one solution for our current childcare crisis. And while universal childcare seems very pie in the sky right now, there are ways to pay for it. As we look towards 2024 and beyond, the real question is, can our politics make it happen? That's all for us today. Thank you to Catherine Ann Edwards for joining me. And thank you to our listener, Ella, for the question. If you have a question or an idea of your own, email it to weeds@vox.com. Our producers, Sophie Lalonde, Rob Byers engineered this episode, Melissa Hirsch fact-checked it, our editorial director is A.M. Hall, and I'm your host, Jonquilin Hill. Music in today's episode is from APM and Kevin McLeod. This podcast is part of Vox, which doesn't have a paywall. Help us keep it that way by going to vox.com/give.
In U.S. working forests, or forest land carefully managed to provide a steady, renewable supply of wood for daily use, more than 1 billion trees are planted every year, and forestry experts protect and manage hundreds of millions of acres. Working forests have been sustainably managed for decades. How? It's simple. They plant more trees than they harvest. Learn more at workingforestsinitiative.com.